The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from the Harvard Health Letter and probably from the Harvard Heart Letter as well. The first article comes from the Harvard Health Letter of September 2021 and is entitled, How Many Fruit and Vegetables Do We Really Need? Here are the numbers to hit and some ways to sneak more fruits and vegetables into your diet. We often talk about how diets rich in fruits and vegetables are good for your health, but how much do you need to average per day to reap real rewards? An analysis from Harvard indicates that a total of 5 servings per day of fruits and vegetables offers the strongest health benefits. The research, published online March 1, 2021 by the journal Circulation, pooled self-reported health and diet information from dozens of studies from around the world, which included about 2 million people who were followed for up to 30 years. Compared with people who said they ate just 2 servings of fruits or vegetables each day, people who ate 5 servings had a 13% lower risk of death from any cause, a 12% lower risk of death from heart disease or stroke, a 10% lower risk of death from cancer, and a 35% lower risk of death from respiratory disease like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Fruits and vegetables are a major source of several nutrients that are strongly linked to good health, particularly the health of your heart and blood vessels, potassium, magnesium, fiber, and polyphenols, which are antioxidant plant compounds, explains Dr. Daniel Wang, lead authority on the study and a member of the Faculty of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. The most effective combinations of fruits and vegetables among study participants was 2 servings of fruits and 3 servings of vegetables every day, making up a total of 5 servings. The biggest health benefit came from eating leafy green vegetables like kale and spinach, and fruits and vegetables rich in vitamin C like citrus, berries, and carrots. These are primary sources of antioxidants that may help play a role in preventing cancer. Eating more than 5 servings of fruits or vegetables per day did not seem to provide any additional benefit. Neither did eating starchy vegetables like peas, corn, or potatoes, or drinking fruit juices. Also understand that we're talking about how much you eat on average. If during any particular day you have no fruits or vegetables, you won't keel over. You can add a little more than usual on other days to raise your average for the week. You can accomplish these goals with minor changes. For example, breakfast could be a bowl of cereal with some blueberries, or perhaps eggs with sautéed tomatoes, onions, and spinach. Lunch could be a salad with your favorite fruits and vegetables. Perhaps a kale and spinach salad with grapefruit chunks, red peppers, carrots, and pine nuts. A cup of yogurt with strawberries, or a smoothie with kale and mango. At dinner, include a side salad or a large side of vegetables like steamed broccoli or yellow squash and zucchini. If you haven't had a chance to eat enough vegetables throughout the day, Make your main meal a large salad with lots of colorful vegetables and some chunks of protein, like grilled chicken or fish. For dessert, think about having fresh or frozen fruit. If 5 servings per day is the goal, how much exactly is a serving? The article includes a useful table that tries to explain this. And I'll give some examples. An example of a serving of fruit would be 1 apple, 1/2 cup of avocado, 1 banana, 1/2 cup of blueberries, 1/4 cantaloupe, 1/2 grapefruit, or 1 orange. It could also be 1 ounce of raisins. An example of a serving of vegetables would be 1/2 cup of broccoli, 2 or 3 ounces of carrot juice, 2 or 4 carrot sticks, 2 or 3 celery sticks, 1/2 cup of kale, or 1/2 cup of cooked spinach. The next article from the Harvard Health Letter of September 2021 is called, Can We Prevent Urinary Tract Infections? These are the steps to take when you're trying to ward off urinary tract infections. If you haven't experienced a urinary tract infection before, take note. While the infections are uncommon in older men, they can be very common in older women, occurring in 10% of women age 65 or older, and about 30% of women age 85 or older. For up to 1/3 of women who have a urinary tract infection, the infection comes back within 6 months. E. coli bacteria, which live in the intestines, cause approximately 80% of all recurrent urinary tract infections, and continue generating microbe strains that are resistant to antibiotics. The ability of the bacteria to stick to the urinary tract can sometimes make them very difficult to eliminate, says Edward Doherty, who spent 10 years working on potential vaccines for recurrent urinary tract infection and other conditions at Harvard's Weiss Institute, and is now CEO and co-founder of vaccine maker Ativer Therapeutics. UTIs can rise anywhere in the urinary tract, the kidneys, the bladder, the ureters, which are the tubes that take urine from the kidneys to the bladder, or the urethra, which is a tube that carries urine out of the body. Female anatomy, specifically the short urethra, which opens to the outside world just above the vagina, affects women's susceptibility. That's because bacteria from the rectum, especially E. coli, can be pushed to the opening of the urethra through wiping or sexual intercourse. Then they can travel up the urethra to the bladder. Men rarely get urinary tract infections because of their longer urethra, explains Dr. Michael O'Leary, a urologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. But sometimes a man's enlarged prostate impedes the flow of urine from the bladder, causing urine to pool and creating a breeding ground for bacteria. UTI symptoms usually include a burning feeling with urination, an urgent need to urinate, frequent urination, bloody or cloudy urine, and fever. Sometimes doctors treat UTIs based only on symptoms, but the most accurate diagnosis requires a urine test to check for white blood cells and bacteria, and then a urine culture to grow bacteria in a lab and see which types are present. A course of antibiotics should clear up the infection. Older women can carry bacteria in their bladders without an infection or symptoms. A condition called asymptomatic bacteriuria. Women with asymptomatic bacteriuria should not be treated, Dr. O'Leary says, it's not necessary, and treatment can lead to antibiotic resistance. Doherty, that's Dr. Edward Doherty mentioned previously, and his team started their company to license the vaccine technology developed at Harvard and then tested in humans. This vaccine and others being tested generally aim to prevent recurrent urinary tract infections by targeting the mechanism bacteria use to stick to the lining of the urinary tract. Some doctors, including Dr. O'Leary, are skeptical a vaccine could ever completely prevent UTIs. There are many different bacterial causes, and one vaccine may not cover them all, he says. Still, given how commonly the responsible bacterium is E. coli, a vaccine targeting E. coli could go a long way toward preventing many, if not all, recurrent urinary tract infections. So what can a woman do to prevent urinary tract infections? Some women are prone to frequent or recurrent urinary tract infection. Here are strategies that can help to ward them off. First, drink a lot of water each day to flush out the urinary tract. Then, empty your bladder immediately after sexual intercourse. If you're a postmenopausal woman, consider using vaginal estrogen cream to help inhibit bad bacteria from living near the urethral opening. If you're a woman of any age, wipe front to back after going to the bathroom. Wiping from back to front carries bad bacteria toward the urethral opening. Consider a daily, long-term, low-dose antibiotic, although this has a risk of encouraging antibiotic resistance. If your urinary tract infections often follow sexual intercourse, take a single dose of an antibiotic after sexual intercourse. There's mixed evidence that cranberry products can work. Cranberries contain natural chemicals that may keep bacteria from adhering to the urinary tract lining. But cranberry juice is very high in sugar. Stick with tablets instead, O'Leary says. The American Urologic Association notes it's okay to try cranberry to avoid UTIs, but the group has not found evidence that any other supplements, including D-mannose, herbs, hyaluronic acid, or chondroitin, will help prevent urinary tract infections. Now in the Harvard Health Letter, we're going to turn to Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, Editor-in-Chief. And the question is it true that people are more likely to develop other diseases after recovering from COVID-19? And Dr. Komaroff answers, as we discussed in our January 2021 issue, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 can permanently injure the lungs, the heart muscle, the kidneys, the brains, and other organs. In addition, some people who recover from the worst symptoms of COVID can be left with debilitating fatigue, difficulty thinking, and other symptoms that make it hard to function normally at work or home. And these people are called long haulers, H-A-U-L-E-R-S. If this suffering was not enough, it's becoming clear that people who recover from COVID have an increased risk of developing a variety of other diseases. A study published online April 22, 2021, by the journal Nature compared 73,000 U.S. veterans who survived COVID to 5 million non-hospitalized veterans without COVID and to another large group with pneumonia caused by influenza. The two comparison groups were similar to the COVID group in terms of age, sex, race, and ethnicity. the neighborhood where they lived, their past medical history, and their use of medical services. All groups were followed for an average of 4 months. During that time, people who recovered from COVID were more likely to develop new health problems, like heart attacks, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, inflammation of their muscles, and blood clots that traveled to the lungs. The risk of dying during the study was 60% higher for the COVID patients. Something about the way the body responded to the coronavirus caused people to become more vulnerable to diseases, even after symptoms caused by the virus ended. Although the risk of these diseases was highest in people who'd been sickest with COVID, even those who were mildly ill had an increased risk. And a British study published online April 6, 2021, by Lancet Psychiatry, compared 236,000 COVID patients to an even larger number of people who experienced other respiratory infections during the same time period and who were otherwise similar. During the 6 months following recovery from COVID, the risk of several brain conditions, including strokes from clots or hemorrhages or psychosis, were higher. Each of these conditions can occur while someone is sick with COVID, but it was a surprise to learn that the increased risk persists even after COVID symptoms have resolved. And by COVID symptoms, they mean pneumonia, fever, loss of ability to smell, and others. Bottom line, COVID is even more dangerous for your health than we thought. The available vaccines offer very strong protection. With 150 million people in the United States having been vaccinated already, we can say with confidence that serious side effects of vaccination are rare. If you haven't been vaccinated yet, you owe it to yourself, your family and friends, and your community to do it. And this is certainly very, very good advice. Now in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, I'm going to read a brief article that's called Replacing and Regenerating the Larynx. People with throat cancer who undergo a total laryngectomy, surgery to fully remove the voice box, find their lives drastically changed. They must breathe through a hole in the neck called a tracheostoma, and they can't speak with a natural voice. They must relearn how to speak, and their sense of smell is greatly diminished. But recent advances provide hope for those facing partial or complete removal of the larynx. The Mayo Clinic is going to be among the first to incorporate advances in microsurgery and offer larynx transplantation. A transplant may allow those who have a total laryngectomy to smell and swallow more normally and speak more naturally. The clinic will perform a first-of-its-kind larynx transplant clinical trial, and the results will be evaluated for use in standard care. Transplant recipients will require lifelong immunosuppressants to prevent organ rejection. When cancer affects only part of the larynx, it's possible to remove just the diseased portion while preserving the rest. Mayo Clinic specialists can use CT scans to create a 3D replica with exact dimensions of the section that was removed. The 3D framework is printed and then is implanted within the larynx. Then, a muscle flap from elsewhere in the body is used to cover the implant. Over time, soft tissue grows into the framework, regenerating the missing portion. The Mayo Clinic is also investigating whether the use of stem cells and growth factors seated within the 3D framework will regenerate larynx tissue without the need for a muscle flap. which could aid the healing process. The hope is that 3D implants using stem cells will be available for clinical trials by 2022. Also in this Mayo Clinic Health letter, there's a short article entitled, "Keep Smartphones Away from Implantable Heart Devices." While many people still rely on cords to change their cell phones, recent devices also offer wireless charging capabilities and can be charged when placed on top of a specialized pad or mat. This technology, which was expanded with the iPhone 12, creates opportunities for convenience, but it also requires internal parts that pose health risks for people who have implantable devices to treat certain heart conditions. Researchers have found that the Apple iPhone 12, which was first sold in October of 2020, can interfere with or prevent appropriate function of the implantable cardioverter defibrillator device. This is called the ICD. An ICD is used to treat heart rhythm irregularities. In the January 2021 issue of Heart Rhythm, the researchers say that the new iPhone's larger internal magnets, which allow it to establish strong wireless charging connections, cause the higher risk of interference. The negative reactions occur most often when the phones are kept within 6 inches of the implanted device for an extended time. Other devices, including magnetic resonance imaging machines and some power tools, also have been associated with an increased risk of malfunction in ICDs. This report reinforces the need to use electronic devices with caution around ICDs. Keep handheld electronic devices a safe distance, 6 to 12 inches at minimum, from the chests of people with ICDs. Don't store the device in a breast pocket. When holding the device, use the hand opposite the side of your body that contains the ICD. When lying down, store the device a few feet away. Don't leave it with you on the couch or on the bed. Now I'm going to turn to the Harvard Heart Letter for September of 2021. And the first article I'm going to talk about is entitled, "Screening for Atrial Fibrillation, an Update." Wearable devices can detect this often silent heart disorder, but as screening tools, they're not ready for prime time yet. Nearly 1 in 11 people aged 65 and older have atrial fibrillation, a heart rhythm disorder that causes bouts of rapid, irregular heartbeat. These unpredictable episodes, which may be fleeting or last for weeks or longer, may trigger symptoms like dizziness or breathlessness, but not always. The greatest threat from atrial fib comes from the heightened risk of stroke that accompanies the condition. Because the heart's upper chambers don't contract regularly, blood may stagnate in the left atrium and form clots. If a clot escapes, it can travel to the brain and cause a stroke. That potentially devastating outcome explains the ongoing effort to find an accurate, cost-effective method to detect atrial fib, especially silent atrial fib, which causes no symptoms and often remains unrecognized. The idea is to catch atrial fib soon enough so a person can start taking anti-clotting drugs to help prevent a stroke, says Harvard Medical School professor Dr. Peter Zimetbaum, director of clinical cardiology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Currently, doctors screen for atrial fib during routine checkups by asking people if they have any atrial fib symptoms and sometimes by doing an electrocardiogram, a short recording of the heart's electrical activity. But because AFib is usually transient, This strategy misses many cases. That's also true for things like monitoring a person's pulse at the wrist or neck for one full minute to check for fast or irregular heartbeat. Home blood pressure monitors sometimes detect atrial fib, as they also measure the user's heart rate. Some smartwatches and wrist-worn activity monitors feature programs that record ECGs. You open the app and touch sensors on the device, and it records your heart rhythm for 30 seconds. If atrial fib is detected, you receive an alert and a report you can share with your physician. That sounds simple. It's more complicated than you might assume, though. For one thing, the algorithms to detect atrial fib aren't completely accurate, and some reports can't be interpreted. Various things can throw off the recording, including movement, skin color, or environmental conditions like lighting and temperature. Another big issue is the reports can present an overwhelming amount of work for physicians, especially if they must sort through unusable data. We don't have a system in place to manage all that information. Even if the device correctly identifies an episode of atrial fib, that doesn't necessarily mean you need treatment. For now, experts don't know what burden of atrial fib warrants putting people on anti-clotting medication, which points to another key message. There's no point in screening people who don't have symptoms of atrial fib unless they are prepared to consider taking blood thinners for the rest of their life. For people at high risk for atrial fib, especially older people, doctors may use longer-term ECG monitoring devices. An implanted loop recorder, a key-sized device placed under the skin of your chest, can monitor your heart rhythm for 3 years. But this somewhat invasive and costly procedure is usually reserved for people with unexplained strokes or fainting spells. Another option is a Band-Aid-sized patch you wear on your chest for 2 weeks. If the patch doesn't detect any atrial fib during that time period, there's no guarantee that you don't have atrial fib. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I sure hope you enjoyed it.